Chapter 7 Bitcoin's Number Go Up Technology. If you zoom out, you can clearly see a pattern of four cycles or stages through Bitcoin's history. Each cycle propels the price and adoption higher than the last. The cycles appear to be triggered by the halving, when Bitcoin's daily supply is cut by 50%. It's Number Go Up Technology. After the 2020 halving, when MicroStrategy executed its Bitcoin purchase, I believe we entered stage 4, where Bitcoin finally established itself as a treasury reserve asset. A true store of value and a legitimate inflation hedge worthy of a place on public company balance sheets. The cycle of peaks and troughs lasts roughly 4 years. The peaks end in wild euphoria, like the Lambo-fueled bubble of 2017, and the troughs bottom out in a depressing storm of Bitcoin is dead articles on Bloomberg. But notice how each peak is higher than the last, and each dip forms a new floor for the price, significantly higher than before. This marks the beginning of a new stage. Each bubble peak is a giant marketing campaign for Bitcoin. Some Bitcoiners might hate the idea of marketing, but these hype cycles are exactly that. As the price goes up, the Bitcoin headlines get bigger. People start talking. The YouTube videos get more hyped up and greedy. The price keeps rising. Everyone boasts about their big gains, so their friends start buying too. It's a virtuous cycle. It's on daytime TV. Then it's your uncle, then your cab driver. It gets everyone talking. Each bubble brings in a flood of new money and new investors. Many of them are just riding the wave, trying to get rich quick. And then the bubble pops. The early investors take profits off the table. Miners sell their stash to secure their business expenses for the next couple of years. The price begins to fall and we go into another dark crypto winter, where Bitcoin sheds 70 to 80% of its value. Most of the get-rich-quick speculators disappear, but some of them stick around. Maybe they read more about Bitcoin and started going down the rabbit hole. They learn about the four-year cycles and why Bitcoin matters. Even as the price goes down, they get more conviction. At the same time, all the hardcore Bitcoiners who have been through this cycle before are accumulating as the price drops. You can see it happening in the data. With every big drawdown, Bitcoiners start scooping up more Bitcoin. The money is transferred from weak hands to rock-solid hands like Michael Saylor and me. It creates a new floor on the price of Bitcoin, higher than the last, strengthened by a new wave of hodlers. The hype cycle works. Each bubble attracts more hardcore Bitcoiners. More talented people quit their job and move into crypto, strengthening the ecosystem. This is another thing that tipped me over the edge into Bitcoin. I couldn't believe how many smart people were giving up their cushy jobs in Silicon Valley and Wall Street to devote themselves to cryptocurrency. I'd never seen a brain drain like it. Trust me, the smartest people in the world are working in crypto right now. Developers, investors, traders, journalists, entrepreneurs. Every cycle attracts a new crop of talent to build the next cycle. Here's how it has played out so far. Stage 1. Libertarians, cypherpunks, and drug dealers. Stage 2. Silicon Valley tech crowd. Stage 3. Early retail speculators and early institutions. Stage 4. Corporate treasury adoption. Stage 5. Nation-state adoption. As public companies like MicroStrategy start adopting Bitcoin as a reserve asset, it's a good idea to look back on how BTC has evolved and how far we've come. Stage 1. Libertarians, cypherpunks, and drug dealers. I was at a party one night and someone was telling me about this thing called Silk Road and Bitcoin and how you can order essentially anything you want online. I bought my first Bitcoin. I went on Silk Road and ordered some ecstasy from Europe. Lo and behold, 2 weeks later, it shows up in this unmarked envelope. I was just blown away. Blown away, completely floored. I just sat back, literally in awe. Anonymous Silk Road user, speaking on the Tales from the Crypt podcast. This is the story that defines Bitcoin's first phase. The Silk Road was an infamous dark web marketplace where you could buy drugs, weapons, and various criminal services with relative anonymity. It was only accessible by routing through the secretive TOR network, and you couldn't pay with dollars, only Bitcoin. The website blew up in mid-2011 when Gawker published an article titled, "The Underground Website Where You Can Buy Any Drug Imaginable." The author described it as Amazon, if Amazon sold mind-altering chemicals. It was the first online black market. You could scroll through pages of drugs and weapons. Acid, cannabis, cocaine, steroids, AR-15s, Glock 19s, and add them to your digital basket. Every seller had a rating, and buyers left helpful reviews under each product. It was a lot like eBay, the anonymous Silk Road user explained. It was actually a pretty good user experience. Better than buying from a sketchy dealer on the street. Until now, Bitcoin was just an experiment for cryptographers and cypherpunks. All of a sudden, it had a use case, and demand for BTC exploded. In 2011, 2 years after Bitcoin was created, the price shot up to its first big bubble of $31. Imagine looking back and thinking $31 was a bubble. The Silk Road, like Bitcoin, was a fiercely libertarian idea. The website's founder, Ross Ulbricht, said Silk Road was supposed to be about giving people the freedom to make their own choices, to pursue their own happiness. Early Bitcoiners shared this libertarian idea. They thought governments should get out the way and markets should be free and open. So when Bitcoin, this stateless cryptocurrency beyond the reach of governments, came along, it clicked immediately. Another early adopter, Eric Voorhees, who now runs Shapeshift, one of the biggest crypto exchanges out there, summed it up. It just became really obvious that government should have nothing to do with money whatsoever. The government would never give up the control of money. Back in this first phase, Bitcoin was a scrappy and experimental thing, and the narrative was all about payments. Early adopters wanted to prove that Bitcoin could be used like real currency. You've probably all heard the story of Laszlo Hanyacz, the guy who bought two pizzas for 10,000 Bitcoin. In May 2010, Hanyacz logged on to the old Bitcoin Talk forum and wrote, "I'll pay 10,000 Bitcoins for a couple of pizzas, like maybe two large ones so I have some left over for the next day. I like having leftover pizza to nibble on later." Someone accepted the offer, and this became the first commercial Bitcoin transaction. That was the original use case, he later said, a payment system. Flash forward to today, and those 10,000 BTC would be worth $110 million. Hanyacz basically bought the most expensive pizza in history. This is one of the key things I want you to take away from this book. Bitcoin's main use case is not payments, yet. The best use case for Bitcoin right now is holding. It's an emerging store of value. We are still early. I believe there are decades of price appreciation ahead of us as Bitcoin evolves into the next global reserve currency. And these things take time. Don't be the guy that threw away 10,000 Bitcoin on a pizza. When Bitcoin's narrative as an anarchist payment system fizzled out, people began to think of it like gold, a scarce store of value. Bitcoin's second cycle, early Silicon Valley crowd. Our thesis at the time was that it was going to disrupt gold, and gold has a market cap of $7 trillion today. So if Bitcoin's going to be worth $7 trillion or more, this is a cheap asset. The Winklevoss twins. In 2012, Cameron and Tyler Winklevoss were cooling off in Ibiza, trying to figure out what the hell to do next. It was 4 years since they settled a lawsuit with Mark Zuckerberg for $65 million over the Facebook debacle. If you've seen The Social Network, you know how that played out. Back at college, the 6'5" twin rowers hired Zuckerberg to work on their project, Harvard Connection, before he ghosted them and quietly built the Facebook.com, a social network suspiciously similar to Harvard Connection. The twins sued Zuckerberg and settled for $65 million in cash and Facebook shares. Cameron and Tyler took that money to Silicon Valley and tried to break into the venture capital world. But they burned out. Not a single startup in San Francisco would take their money. Ben Mezrich, who wrote Bitcoin Billionaires, explained, "Nobody wants their money because everyone's endgame is to sell their company to Facebook. And because Zuckerberg hates the Winklevoss twins so much, that becomes an impossibility." Tech founders literally turned down their checks and cancelled meetings with the Winklevi. The twins were feeling pretty broken. Back in Ibiza, at the Blue Marlin Beach Bar, buzzing with celebrities and millionaires, one man sat next to the Winklevi and started blabbering about some digital internet currency. Bitcoin. They tried to ignore the guy at first, just another chancer trying to pitch ideas at the beach bar. But something caught their attention. Maybe this was it. Maybe this was a new route for them. "We were super fascinated with it," Tyler later explained. "This was money that works like an email. That was the aha moment for us." Cameron knew that it was super risky, but it could be huge. This is either the next big thing or total BS. From the swanky offices of Silicon Valley, the Winklevi suddenly found themselves in a dusty basement in Brooklyn, New York, where an excitable 22-year-old was running the most important company in Bitcoin, BitInstant. Charlie Schrem founded BitInstant as a quick way for Americans to buy Bitcoin. Until now, US citizens had to wire money to a sketchy exchange in Japan, called Mt. Gox. It took days, and you never knew if your money would get there safely. Super complicated. BitInstant acted as a middleman between Mt. Gox and US buyers. Schrem would purchase a ton of Bitcoin with his Mt. Gox account and sell it to Americans directly. By Schrem's side was Eric Voorhees, the libertarian early adopter, who came on board as head of marketing, while Roger Ver watched over it all as an early investor. This was a scrappy libertarian clique, trying to build a parallel financial system. A complete Wild West, the twins later said. And in walks the Winklevi, Harvard-educated Olympians in suits, the elite, the man that these libertarians hoped to dismantle. But money is money, and Schrem needed the cash to keep the company going. The twins invested $1 million in BitInstant, and by 2013, Charlie Schrem's startup was handling 30% of all global Bitcoin transactions. This is another common theme for each of Bitcoin's cycles. Every parabolic bubble is triggered by a new wave of liquidity. An easier way to buy Bitcoin. In Bitcoin's second cycle, that was BitInstant and Mt. Gox. At the same time, Cameron and Tyler were plowing their settlement money into Bitcoin itself. They bought up 1% of the entire BTC supply, starting when the price was around $8 to $9. They even set up an elaborate cold storage system to hide their new digital wealth. They smashed all the computers they used to purchase Bitcoin, wrote the private keys on pieces of paper by hand, cut them up and placed them in different safety deposit vaults in banks around America. Back then, we didn't have the fortress of Bitcoin custody solutions we have now. Over the next couple of years, a small handful of Silicon Valley investors started to take notice. Secretive Bitcoin anonymous groups popped up, with early adopters like Naval Ravikant, a now-famous tech investor, Peter Thiel, and Max Levchin from the PayPal Mafia, and a host of engineers and developers. These guys were buying up huge chunks of Bitcoin supply, pushing the price up to $1,000 by 2013. The Winklevoss twins set about trying to legitimize Bitcoin. They set up meetings with prominent investment firms. They lobbied the Senate for sensible Bitcoin regulation. They started working on a Bitcoin exchange-traded fund, ETF, which would allow Wall Street to invest. The second cycle also attracted a bunch of new developers and entrepreneurs. Like I said, every cycle draws in new talent and gets them hooked. They quit their jobs, go all in, and build the foundation of the next phase for cryptocurrency. Bitcoin's second phase blew up in spectacular fashion. To explain why, we need to come back to the Amazon of drugs, Silk Road. In October 2013, Ross Ulbricht, the libertarian founder of Silk Road, entered a public library in San Francisco and opened his laptop. A quiet and friendly 29-year-old, Ross sat in the sci-fi section near a window and saw a message pop up on his screen. "Hey, can you log into Silk Road and check something for me?" Ross thought the message was from an employee, known on Silk Road as Cirrus. What Ross didn't know was that Cirrus was an undercover Homeland Security agent. The FBI had been tracking Ross and the Silk Road for months. They'd infiltrated his inner circle, and now they were watching his every move. The FBI suspected he was the mysterious kingpin, using the pseudonym Dread Pirate Roberts, online. Every time Ross opened his laptop, the Dread Pirate Roberts appeared online. Every time Ross closed his laptop, DPR logged off. It all matched up. All they had to do was catch Ross with his computer open. Fingers on keys, they call it in cybersecurity circles. They also had to be quick. A loud SWAT team would be a disaster. Ross would see them coming. He could log out, delete everything, smash the laptop. This was a delicate operation, and they only had one chance to catch him in the act. As soon as Ross logged on to check the technical issue, Cirrus tipped off two agents who were waiting outside the library. They entered in plain clothes and began shouting at each other. "Fuck you!" the female agent screamed right behind Ross's table. The male agent grabbed her by the collar and threatened to punch her. It was a staged fight. When Ross looked up, another planted FBI agent swiped his laptop and passed it to a fourth agent, Tom Kiernan. Kiernan had been given just one job by his superiors. Get the laptop. That's why you're here. Get the laptop and keep it alive. Ross grabbed at the computer, but it was too late. He was arrested and cuffed on the spot. Now they had all the proof they needed to convict him. On the laptop, they found the Silk Road backend where Ross was logged in, as /mastermind, proof that he was running the website. They found financial accounts going back to 2013, hundreds of chat logs, and other incriminating evidence. And crucially, they discovered a stash of 144,000 Bitcoin, which was quickly routed into FBI-controlled wallets. They threw Ross into the back of a cop car and posted a big FBI notice on the website. This hidden site has been seized. The Silk Road was over. The Bitcoin price tumbled more than 20% on that day. Ross's arrest was never really about the Silk Road. It was about the authorities fighting Bitcoin and sending a message. This black market currency is not acceptable. This will be a recurring theme throughout Bitcoin's history. They will fight it, and fight it, and fight it until finally they give in. Unfortunately, along the way, there will be some casualties. The first through the door gets shot, right? Ross Ulbricht took the fall. He got a double life sentence plus 40 years, with no chance of parole. The harshest possible sentence. To this day, he's still campaigning for his freedom. Over the next couple of months, Bitcoin's price actually soared from $110 to a high of $1,242. If anything, all the Silk Road media attention got people more interested in Bitcoin. The second major Bitcoin bubble was in full swing. Where is our money? When Mt. Gox was hacked, Gox was the biggest Bitcoin exchange on the planet, handling up to 70% of all BTC transactions at the time. It was another scrappy Bitcoin company that got in way over its head. I mean, the whole website was originally set up to trade magic, the gathering cards. The name Mt. Gox literally means magic, the gathering online exchange. When Bitcoin started going parabolic for the first time, it was turned into a Bitcoin exchange, totally unprepared for what was coming. Right at the top of the bubble, Mt. Gox was hacked. All withdrawals were frozen. People flew to the Tokyo offices and protested with signs, "Where is our money?" Some had lost hundreds of thousands of dollars. Then the website went dark. Gox admitted they had lost 750,000 customer bitcoins and another 100,000 of its own reserves. That's about 4% of the entire Bitcoin supply vanished. The second Bitcoin bubble popped. The price fell from $1,132 in December 2013 to $500 in February. It wasn't just Mt. Gox either. There was a blow after blow for Bitcoin in those few short months. The Silk Road was taken down. Bang. The Chinese government banned financial institutions from banking Bitcoin companies. Bang. The IRS declared Bitcoin would be taxed as property, which meant huge capital gains bills for traders. Bang. And then China actively closed bank accounts related to Bitcoin companies. Bang, bang, bang. Bitcoin bled out for another 18 months before bottoming at $221. 383 Bitcoin obituaries. At the time of writing this book, Bitcoin has been declared dead 383 times by the mainstream media. There's a website dedicated to tracking the obituaries. In the darkest pits of Bitcoin cycles, critics love to pile on and trash it. These bear markets are painful, but they're also necessary. The tide has to go out sometime. We've got to wash away the tourists, the speculators, the weak hands. As Warren Buffett says, you've got to let the tide go out and see who's swimming naked. Bitcoin's bear markets are when money is transferred from weak hands to rock-solid holders. Bitcoin grows stronger and scarcer in these down cycles because Bitcoin transitions to the hardcore believers. They accumulate at cheap prices. And they don't sell. This is also when we build. The bear markets are a gift for anyone building in the Bitcoin space. All of the mainstream attention disappears. All the speculators vanish. You can get your head down and work hard while no one else is watching. Build the infrastructure and get ready for the next bull run. Like the seasons of the year, Bitcoin's time comes around again. After the 2013 bubble burst, the next bear market got pretty dark. Bitcoin's third cycle, the traders and speculators. Bitcoin has failed. The fundamentals are broken. I will no longer be taking part in Bitcoin development and have sold all my coins. Bitcoin developer Mike Hearn. If you thought the 2018-19 crypto winter was tough, go speak to anyone that was around in 2014 and 2015. That thing was brutal. The biggest Bitcoin exchange had just blown up. Prominent OG Bitcoiners were in jail, China had effectively banned crypto, and the community was deeply divided over how to move forward. Mike Hearn, one of Bitcoin's most important developers, quoted above, rage quit and publicly called Bitcoin a failure. This is when I started taking Bitcoin seriously. Looking from the outside in, it looked like a dumpster fire, and a civil war was brewing. The war revolved around scaling. The Bitcoin network is the most secure and robust network ever created. But it's slow. The Visa network processes an average of 1,700 transactions a second. Bitcoin can do 7. Bitcoin was designed like this on purpose. Think of it like a tank, heavily armored and impossible to penetrate. It's never been hacked, remember? But that armor weighs it down and makes it sluggish. Visa is like a motorbike, fast and nimble, but more likely to crash, easy to steal. Bitcoin is supposed to be a tank. Where would you rather store your wealth? In a tank or on a motorbike? Satoshi coded Bitcoin this way on purpose. He put a 1 megabyte limit on each Bitcoin block. No more than 1 megabyte of transactions will fit inside, which takes 10 minutes to process. Satoshi did this to protect the network from spam and denial of service, DDoS. Denial of service, DDoS attacks. That limit worked just fine in the early days when Bitcoin was a plaything for cypherpunks. But if Bitcoin was to grow into a global money network, the small blocks would quickly get full of transactions and backlog the entire thing. Fees would go sky high. You can't pay for a coffee with Bitcoin if it costs $5 in fees, and you have to wait half an hour for your transaction to go through. As you know, you shouldn't be buying coffee with Bitcoin anyway. So what's the answer? Lots of people in the community wanted to increase the block size. Makes sense, right? Bigger block size, more transactions per block, faster execution. Problem is, if you increase the block size, it gets much harder for the average person to run Bitcoin. You need much more computing power. This is important. Bitcoin is supposed to be decentralized. It's supposed to be downloaded and run by millions of people across the world. The more decentralized it becomes, the more democratic and secure the network. It's not supposed to be controlled by a handful of big players with access to data centers. That would be the exact opposite of why Bitcoin was created. So others argued to keep the block size, but develop a faster second layer on top of Bitcoin. Back in 2010, Bitcoin pioneer Hal Finney saw this coming and suggested something similar. Bitcoin itself cannot scale to have every single financial transaction in the world be broadcast to everyone and included in the blockchain. There needs to be a secondary level of payment systems, which is lighter weight and more efficient. New innovations like the Lightning Network are now being built on top of Bitcoin. The Lightning Network allows you to send small amounts of BTC instantly with almost zero fees. The transaction itself is batched with others and later settled on the Bitcoin blockchain. In other words, Bitcoin is the slow, steady, secure, reliable settlement layer. A strong, impenetrable fortress, the foundation, and faster payment networks can be built on top of it. Still, the debate raged, and because there is no Bitcoin CEO, there was no one to make the final call. A fight for Bitcoin's future. Looking back, this wasn't just a fight over block size. It was a fight over Bitcoin's entire philosophy. Should Bitcoin be the ultra-secure, foundational layer of the future digital economy? Should it be the tank, open and decentralized for anyone to download? Or should it be a super-fast payment network right now? Many wanted the latter. They wanted Bitcoin to be fast and cheap. They thought Bitcoin was useless unless you could buy coffee with it, unless it competed with Visa. But fast payments isn't the revolution here. We already have fast payment systems today. We've got Venmo, and credit cards, and easy money. We don't have a scarce, independent currency, backed by the most secure computing network in all of history that can't be fucked with. As Saifedean Ammous later wrote in 2017, using Bitcoin for consumer purchases is akin to driving a Concorde jet down the street to pick up groceries. A ridiculously expensive waste of an astonishing tool. Bitcoin isn't designed for buying coffee. It's designed to be the next global reserve currency. And that means building a fortress. A global settlement layer where the Bitcoin transactions are giant container ships, not emails, as Castle Island Ventures' Nick Carter puts it. In October 2020, someone sent $1 billion in a single transaction over the Bitcoin network, and it cost them just $3.4 in fees. There is no other money network on the planet that can do this. The average Bitcoin transaction is about $155,000. This is not designed for buying coffee. It's for settling gigantic payments on the most secure network ever invented. It's designed to be a global reserve currency layer. The faster payment network can come later. In mid-2017, the disagreement tore Bitcoin in two. A new version of Bitcoin was launched, called Bitcoin Cash, hell-bent on payment adoption with bigger blocks. Bitcoin Cash was a hard fork of Bitcoin. It shared the same blockchain history, but then forked off to create a new chain. Like a railroad splitter with two tracks going off in separate directions, miners and investors now had to choose which version of Bitcoin to follow. The best thing about Bitcoin is that the market decides. There is no central authority or CEO. People vote with their money or their mining equipment. After the hard fork, Bitcoin Cash traded at $240. Bitcoin held steady at $2,700. The market was pretty clear. The world doesn't need another super fast payment system. We have Visa, Venmo, Cash App. The revolution is bigger than that. We need a whole new system of money. One that's fair and transparent and open to everyone, censorship resistant, scarce and deflationary. The community rallied behind this bigger goal. As I write this today, Bitcoin trades more than 55 times higher than Bitcoin Cash. Bitcoin is the tank. Don't fuck with it. Most of you know what happened next. The 2017 Lambo bubble. Bitcoin broke into all-time highs at the start of the year, and then it just went off like a rocket. You could feel something crazy was happening. Complete greed and FOMO. A lot of it was driven by the rise of Ethereum, the second largest cryptocurrency. Ethereum isn't like Bitcoin. It's not trying to be hard money. It's more like the internet. Ethereum is programmable, which means you could build things on it, just like you build an app on the internet. Ethereum is a very cool project, but it was mostly used for one thing, to create new cryptocurrencies. A tidal wave of new cryptos appeared, hundreds and hundreds of them, and many launched initial coin offerings, ICOs. Basically, a new way to invest in crypto projects. But instead of traditional investing, with all the rules and regulations, you're buying a token on a new blockchain. A total Wild West. I've been investing for decades and I can't describe how insane this was. The numbers we were seeing were beyond ridiculous. $152 million for a cryptocurrency project called Bancor. In one day. Just for comparison, Uber's seed round raised $200,000. Airbnb was $620,000. And here I was watching millions flow into totally unknown crypto projects with nothing but a website and a copy-pasted white paper. Pomp and I talked it through and we stayed the hell away. I've been an investor for a long time and it's never easy to sit on the sidelines while everyone's making a ton of money, but this didn't feel right. The numbers kept getting higher. $157 million for a blockchain phone project, $232 million for Tezos, $320 million for a project called Dragoncoin. And then even after the Bitcoin bubble burst, investors were still throwing money at these ICOs, desperately searching for the next Bitcoin. $4 billion, yes, billion, for something called EOS, bigger than any stock market IPO that year. We were out. Absolutely no way. These things were obviously overvalued, and we were pretty sure they'd get shut down by regulators eventually. We hugged our Bitcoin tight and rode it out. But even the Bitcoin bubble went on to eclipse our craziest predictions, topping out at $20,000 in December 2017. I knew it was getting crazy because hackers were coming at me non-stop. I got SIM swapped. I got my mining operation hacked, and, like I told you in Chapter 2, I had the FBI on my back. It was pretty wild. Even obscure relatives were coming out of the woodwork. Should I buy Bitcoin? It was on daytime TV. Cab drivers were showing me their Coinbase accounts. YouTubers were showing off their Lambos paid in crypto. Even Bitcoiners were getting caught up in the hype. Big names were making $100,000 price predictions. $250,000, $1 million. Everyone kept saying the same thing. The institutions are coming. The Chicago Mercantile Exchange was about to launch a Bitcoin futures exchange. Everyone thought they had front-run Wall Street and got in first. People were selling their homes to buy more Bitcoin. Everyone thought they were going to be rich, but if you know, you know. This was the time to get out of the market. Like JFK's father always used to say, when the shoeshine boy starts giving you investment tips, you run the hell away. And then, finally, the bubble popped. $20,000 to $7,000 in just over a month. Down $3,000 by the end of 2018. Absolutely brutal. As always, things recovered. Everyone forgot about Bitcoin for a while, but we didn't stop building. So what comes next? As I write this, stage 4 is just getting started. This is where Bitcoin establishes itself as a true store of value reserve asset. This isn't just a plaything for traders and speculators anymore. We survived the 2017 bubble and came out stronger. We survived the 2020 financial crash and came out kicking. Bitcoin has arrived as the most important asset class on the planet. It's digital gold on steroids. A hard asset sucking in all the value from infinite fiat currencies. MicroStrategy and Square kick-started this cycle by adding Bitcoin to their treasury. Next, nation states. But we'll get to that. Before we go really deep down the rabbit hole of Bitcoin becoming a global reserve currency, I want to explain why Bitcoin matters from an investment perspective. Even if you don't believe that Bitcoin can replace the dollar one day, you can at least appreciate why it needs to be in your portfolio, and that its price is destined to go up. Chapter 8. The Investment Case for Bitcoin. Anyone who's been in the Bitcoin space for 5 minutes knows the name Nouriel Roubini, an economist with the nickname Dr. Doom. Roubini is one of Bitcoin's loudest and most aggressive critics. He called crypto the mother and father of all scams in a statement to Congress. And he loves to gloat when the Bitcoin price goes down. BTC is a shitty shitcoin hedge, he tweeted after an 8% fall. A rigged, totally manipulated, whales-controlled market. Massive pump-and-dump, spoofing, front-running, wash trading. Total scam, he tweeted after a 15% down day. When he's not trashing Bitcoin or predicting recessions, he comes after me in pomp directly. One angry day, he slammed us for working out of a Starbucks. Their office is appropriately located in a Starbucks restroom, one step up from that shitcoin-stinking cesspool. He blocked me on Twitter. Still makes me sad to this day. Maybe he will unblock me once Bitcoin moons. He thinks it's an insult, but we really did build our fund out of a Starbucks in North Carolina. And we're proud of it. We might be the only people to deploy tens of millions of dollars from a coffee shop. By now, the fund was focused mainly on companies in the Bitcoin and blockchain space. We invested in Coinbase, BlockFi, and Bakkt. It was an infrastructure play. Our goal was to help build the foundations of a new financial system. But we had big dreams of bringing institutional money to Bitcoin. We had a pure and convincing thesis, but you can't get traditional investors to allocate money from a Starbucks. There's a process for wooing them, an etiquette. That's where Mark Yusko came in. While me and Pomp were working out of a coffee shop, Mark Yusko was in a palatial office in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The man is professional to a T. And he's been in the game a long time. Former senior investment director at Notre Dame, chief investment officer at University of North Carolina's endowment, $5 billion under management. Best of all, he was a Bitcoiner. Pomp laid the groundwork with a couple of meetings, and then the three of us met. I think Mark was about ready to turn and leave when he saw me. I came straight from the PRTI plant. Construction boots, high-vis jacket, big beard, tatted up. Who is this guy? We might have come from different worlds, but Mark understood the Bitcoin thesis. He'd been investing in disruptive tech his whole career, a big deal for the conservative university endowments he ran. He also knew what was going on at central banks. Money printing, QE. He always talked about zombie companies in the stock market, propped up by free-flowing credit. Mark got it. Together, we set up Morgan Creek Digital. Finally, we had a way for institutions to invest in a Bitcoin fund. Mark introduced us to some of his traditional investor clients, and we worked on messages they would be receptive to. Don't say Bitcoin will take down the traditional financial system. These guys made all their money from the traditional financial system. Tell them it's an uncorrelated asset with the best returns of the last decade that will create a more attractive risk-adjusted return. That last bit is hard to ignore. Bitcoin is the best performing asset in the last 5 years, the last 10 years. Up 4,000% since 2015. Up 16,666,566% in the last decade. Holding Bitcoin for a year during almost any part of its history has produced positive returns. And you don't need much to make a difference. According to a Bitwise study in 2020, a 2.5% allocation to Bitcoin over the last 6 years boosts the cumulative returns of a traditional portfolio. 60% stocks, 40% bonds, from 26.2% to 44.9%, and barely alters the overall volatility. Make it 5%, and the cumulative returns jump to 65.1%. The risk-to-return profile is unlike any other asset class I've ever known, too. If you've got a 1% allocation, your risk is very low. Sure, there's a tiny chance Bitcoin goes to zero and you lose 1%. Annoying, but not the end of the world. But that small Bitcoin position has the potential to times 10, times 100 over the next decade. Maybe more if I'm right about the global reserve currency thing. We call this asymmetric returns. Chance of a small loss, but insane upside. Investors measure this risk-return rate by a Sharpe ratio. Bitcoin's Sharpe ratio is the highest of any asset class, ever. And it's not correlated to anything else. This is an investor's dream. Portfolio managers love assets that aren't correlated. You want your portfolio to weather different storms. You don't want all your assets going down at the same time. Bitcoin has almost zero correlation to stocks, gold, bonds, commodities, anything. It's a whole new asset class. If I walked into a meeting and told an investor I found the best performing asset on the planet, with the best Sharpe ratio in history, totally uncorrelated to anything else in their portfolio, they'd bite my hand off. Then I tell them it's Bitcoin. They go quiet. Come on! How long can investors keep ignoring all this before their clients fire them? We started going into meetings and boldly telling money managers that it was irresponsible not to have exposure to Bitcoin. I'm talking about heavyweight institutions. Pomp would absolutely hit them with, "It's your fiduciary responsibility to have a position." And that was back when we used to push for 1% allocation. Our pitch was get off zero. Even if you're not fully confident about Bitcoin yet, zero is the wrong number. You've got to get some exposure, just in case. Now, we're even more convicted. Now I tell people 1% isn't enough. 1% isn't financially responsible. Keeping an outsized position in cash isn't responsible. And even Wall Street is coming around. Fidelity now recommends a 5% portfolio holding of Bitcoin. Even JP Morgan analysts caved in and recommended Bitcoin to its clients. They said it could triple in price and challenge gold. I feel pretty vindicated when these guys finally show up. So why am I so convinced? Forget all the macro stuff for a minute. Forget money printing and inflation. The simple reason for Bitcoin's inevitable price rise is what I keep coming back to. 21 million. The fixed supply. The algorithmic schedule. The halving. These are built-in features that make Bitcoin go up. The simplest asset on the planet. People think Bitcoin is complicated. They think economics is complicated. It's not. It's all just supply and demand. Think about it. The halving cuts Bitcoin supply in half every 4 years. A monster supply shock. Put that in perspective for a second. Imagine if the world's oil giants cut production in half overnight. What would happen? there's still the same amount of demand. We still gotta fill our cars up with gas. But now there's less oil available. The price has got to go up. Let's bring Harold back to explain in simple terms again. Harold draws a pizza cart. Harold can only draw and serve 100 pizzas per day, but there are 1,000 hungry customers lined up. There isn't enough pizza for everyone. So what happens? Someone in the queue shouts through the crowd, "He'll pay double for a slice because he's really hungry." Harold sells him a slice for $10 instead of $5. Someone else shouts out, "I'll pay $10 too." Someone else jumps in, "Me too." When demand is high, it pushes prices up. Harold quickly scrubs out the $5 a slice sign and makes it $10 across the board. Now someone else in the crowd shouts, "I'll pay $15. Now Harold increases the price to $15, and then $20. All of a sudden, a $5 pizza slice has quadrupled in value to $20. This is the free market at work. A limited supply and lots of demand means the price goes up. But in most markets, the supply changes to meet the demand. Harold would call up his buddies and get them to come help. They'd ramp up the supply of pizzas so they could feed the 1,000 hungry people. Maybe other pizza carts hear about the demand and come running. All of a sudden, there's plenty of pizza to go around, and no one's willing to pay $20 for a slice anymore. Pizza is back to $5 a slice. It's the same in big businesses. If demand for iPhones goes up, Apple ramps up the supply chain to make more. If demand slows down, they reduce the supply. Same with oil, same with gold, same with dollars and every other fiat currency. They print money to meet the bank's demand for liquidity. Bitcoin doesn't work like this. Bitcoin is like Harold's first pizza cart. There's a fixed supply no matter what. Just like Harold can only make 100 pizzas per day, the Bitcoin network only mints 900 BTC per day. We literally cannot create any more. If thousands of people show up to buy Bitcoin, they'll be forced to pay more. And then the halving kicks in. Imagine that Harold's pizza supply gets cut in half. Now he can only make 50 pizzas per day, but there's still 1,000 people queuing up to buy. Or imagine if demand increases. What if there's now 2,000 people queuing up? Everyone heard how great the pizzas are. The demand ratio is even higher. Now people are shouting even louder. "I'll pay $30 a slice. I'll pay $40. Harold ramps up his prices even more. With Bitcoin, this will compound over decades and decades. Demand for Bitcoin will rise exponentially, while the daily supply will always decrease. It's designed to pump forever. Here's how it plays out in reality. In early 2020, Square was buying up 20% of all the newly minted BTC for the Cash app. In May 2020, the halving kicked in. But Square's demand stayed the same. Now they're buying 40% of all new BTC. Pure and simple economics. If supply goes down and demand stays the same, the price goes up. That's why Bitcoin is the simplest asset on the planet. But this same system also means Bitcoin will go through brutal crashes. In the harsh depths of Bitcoin pizza winter, when all the hype and excitement around Harold's pizza has gone, his cart keeps on pumping out the same number of pizzas every day. Only there are fewer people around to buy them. Now there's more supply than demand. Pizzas are sitting on the side going cold. Harold just wants to get rid of them and break even, so he starts accepting a lower price. A few opportunistic people gather around the cart and buy 6 pizzas at a time for $5. This is the accumulation phase that happens during Bitcoin winters. Whales stock up at low prices so they can sell higher when the hype comes back. This is how Bitcoin hype cycles work. We get big, parabolic bubbles as people are willing to pay ridiculous prices to get the limited supply of Bitcoin. When the hype dies down, the price dumps and forms the trough until the next cycle of interest comes around again. It's volatile, but it makes Bitcoin the most simple asset on the planet because only one thing matters: demand. It's really that straightforward. As an investor, you only have to ask yourself one question. Do you think demand for Bitcoin will be higher in 5 to 10 years? If yes, then the price will go up. Do you think demand for Bitcoin will decline? Then just don't buy it. It's the simplest investment thesis on the planet. You can't say this about any other asset. Take oil. Let's say I think demand for oil will be higher in 5 to 10 years. I can't automatically assume this means the price goes up. Even if I'm right and demand goes up, Saudi Arabia and Iran and Russia could ramp up the supply and flood the market with oil. Sure, demand has gone up, but so has supply. So the price stays the same, or maybe even falls. Same with gold. I'm pretty sure the demand for gold will go up in the next 5 to 10 years. But if the price goes up, gold miners go into overdrive and start increasing the supply of gold. Or what if we figure out a new way to retrieve gold from the ocean? That could push the price back down again. Same with stocks. Maybe I think demand for Tesla stock will increase in 5 to 10 years. Price goes up, right? Not necessarily. Elon Musk can easily issue more shares, more supply, and dilute my holdings. Same with dollars. Same with every currency on the planet. With every other asset, you're always trying to analyze this balance between supply and demand. Not with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is easy. The total supply is strictly fixed, and the daily supply is robotic, algorithmic. It's fuck you economics. The supply doesn't move no matter what's going on in the world. It doesn't move or mold itself around the demand. It just is. 6.25 bitcoins every 10 minutes until 2024. And then 3.125 bitcoins every 10 minutes until 2028. And on and on. Bitcoin supply is a rock. A dam. Waves of demand will crash up against the dam and then go back out again. When the waves of demand are big and heavy, the price goes up into bubbles. When the waves go out, the price goes down into deep winters. It's pure and transparent. A totally free market at work. All this only works because of Bitcoin's 21 million hard cap. Like I said, it's hard to overstate this. The revolution is digital scarcity. So there's really only one question to ask yourself if you're an investor. Do you think demand for Bitcoin will rise from here in the future? In February 2019, our Bitcoin thesis convinced two major pension funds to allocate capital, Fairfax County's Virginia's police officers' retirement system and employees' retirement system. We also attracted investment from a hospital system, private foundations, insurance companies, and university endowments. It had never been done before. And I think we were the only team in the space that could make this happen. Mark, the grey-haired veteran with all his professionalism and experience, he normalized us in a way that we could never have done on our own. Pomp, the hype man, a natural marketer and prominent voice in the space, and me, the engineer who built a mining rig at the power plant. We had all the bases covered. We could answer every question and settle all the concerns. We could pitch Bitcoin and digital assets as a legitimate investment from every angle. But we still get one question over and over again. How to value Bitcoin? Me, Pomp, and Mark were visiting another fancy office with two guys in suits on the other side of the table. I know for sure they're not about to allocate any money to Bitcoin. We're only here because their boss heard about the crypto bubble and wants to make sure they've taken a meeting. But we pitch it like we always do. Groundbreaking technology play, digital scarcity, fixed supply, uncorrelated asset, asymmetric returns, inflation hedge, digital gold, and investment in infrastructure. Every now and then you see the light bulb click. They get it, but they still won't take the leap. They've got clients to answer to, a boss above them. They've got a job with a good salary. It's too much career risk for them. They'll wait for someone else to break the trail. The first guy through the door gets shot, remember? And then we get the question we always get. Bitcoin isn't backed by anything. There's no intrinsic value. How the hell do we value it? I bite my tongue and try not to shout, "The dollar isn't backed by anything." Instead, I tell them we've come a long way since the early days of Bitcoin. And we have plenty of real ways to value Bitcoin. Fundamentals, as traditional investors call it. And all of them point to significantly higher prices in the next decade. Stock to flow. In early 2019, another anonymous character entered the Bitcoin community with the Twitter handle at 100 trillion USD and a simple name, Plan B. He published a paper called Modeling Bitcoin Value with Scarcity. He used a mathematical model based on Bitcoin's scarce supply to calculate a median $1 trillion market cap. He used a mathematical model based on Bitcoin's scarce supply to calculate a median $1 trillion market cap for Bitcoin in the next cycle, about $55,000 per Bitcoin. As Plan B has pointed out, Bitcoin has historically overshot the median mark on the model, so the price could go much higher. The hype cycles tend to slingshot the Bitcoin price beyond the model before snapping back. The stock-to-flow model line has acted like gravity. The model is based on something called stock-to-flow ratio, which is often used to measure the scarcity of other hard assets, like gold and precious metals. Plan B wasn't the first to apply this to Bitcoin. Saifedean Ammous talks about this in his book, The Bitcoin Standard. Any object with a high stock-to-flow ratio has been a good form of money throughout history. It's why gold has held its value so well. It has the highest stock-to-flow ratio on Earth. The stock in the equation is the existing amount of Bitcoin in circulation, 18.5 million. The flow is how much new Bitcoin is minted each year, currently 328,500. The equation gives Bitcoin a stock-to-flow ratio of 25. In other terms, it would take 25 years of production to get to the current Bitcoin stock. That puts Bitcoin scarcity somewhere between gold, SF64, and silver, SF22. Somewhere around 2022, Bitcoin's stock-to-flow ratio will rise above gold, making it the world's scarcest asset. Plan B mapped out this stock-to-flow ratio over Bitcoin's price history and found a statistically significant relationship with around 95% correlation. He believes the natural scarcity and programmed supply of Bitcoin has a direct influence on the price. The value steps up after each halving as the stock-to-flow ratio grows higher. Plan B later introduced a second model, the stock-to-flow cross-asset model, S2FX, which extrapolates a BTC price of $228,000 in the next cycle. This model removes time and adds gold and silver to the question. Here, you can see four clusters or phases of Bitcoin. The first cluster is Bitcoin's early proof of concept phase. The second is Bitcoin's narrative as an electronic payment when BTC hit $1. The third is Bitcoin's narrative as digital gold when 1 BTC almost hit 1 ounce of gold. The fourth is Bitcoin's emergence as a financial asset as it hit $1 billion daily transactions. According to Plan B's model, Bitcoin will soon shift into the fifth phase, where it will emerge as a macro asset like silver and eventually gold. The S2FX model has a 99.7% fit to the data. Pretty compelling. I should point out that even Plan B admits that all models are wrong, but some are useful. There's obviously no guarantee that Bitcoin will hit $228,000 in the next cycle. The S2F models simply track Bitcoin's historical price action against supply and extrapolates what happens if the model continues. The S2F model has drawn some criticism. Castle Island Ventures' Nick Carter has probably the soundest critique. Since Bitcoin's supply schedule is already known centuries in advance, he says it's unlikely that it has any power to shock the market or trigger price action. Bitcoin's supply schedule has been known since inception, which simply rules out the claim that issuance changes are the main causal driver behind price action. It's not the supply that affects price, he explains, it's purely demand. Still, it's the first real quantitative model we have to measure Bitcoin's price, a fundamental way of calculating Bitcoin's value. And if he's right, $228,000 is a monster price target for the next cycle. On-chain fundamentals. The guys in suits across the table from us claimed that Bitcoin isn't backed by anything. I'd argue the opposite. It's backed by thousands of miners securing the network. The swarm of cyber hornets. It's backed by millions of active users storing their wealth in BTC and millions more transacting back and forth. You can measure and quantify all this with on-chain data, and almost every metric is bullish. Hash rate measures the amount of computing power being used to secure the network. A high hash rate means the Bitcoin network is more secure because it's harder to initiate a 51% attack and gain more than half the network's mining power. Hash rate is at record highs and climbing exponentially. We already know that Bitcoin is being the most secure computing network on the planet, so extra security is undeniably bullish. Hash rate is also becoming more dispersed between different mining groups over time, an even better indicator of security and decentralization. Since we know that Bitcoin is a store of value, we should also measure how many people are using it to store their wealth. The number of Bitcoin addresses with a non-zero balance is now more than 30 million, eclipsing the peak of the 2017 bubble. The number of Bitcoin addresses holding at least 0.1 BTC is over 3 million, a record high. And the number of whales with over 1,000 BTC has swelled to highs of over 2,000. There are more people opting to store their wealth in Bitcoin than ever before, validating its thesis as a store of value. This data is important for another reason. A high hash rate and more Bitcoin addresses means the system is working as it was designed. Bitcoin is becoming more dispersed and more decentralized. And that's crucial for building a new global economy. If Bitcoin was becoming more centralized and controlled by small entities, I'd be concerned, but that's not happening. There's an entire world of Bitcoin on-chain analysis from companies like Coinmetrics and Glassnode. I suggest diving in and learning more about this. I guarantee it will keep your heart rate steady, even when the Bitcoin price is volatile. As long as you can see mining activity increasing, real transactions, and more value being stored on the network, you'll sleep better at night. The mining floor. There are other theories that support Bitcoin's inevitable climb higher. Some say that Bitcoin has a price floor based on the break-even cost of mining. It makes some sense. Mining Bitcoin costs a lot of money. Huge electricity bills and massive equipment costs. If the Bitcoin price falls below a certain level, mining becomes unprofitable. Satoshi said it himself. It's the same situation as gold and gold mining. The marginal cost of gold mining tends to stay near the price of gold. I think the case will be the same for Bitcoin. At my mine at PRTI, I'm not paying for electricity, but I'm still paying the operating costs of running the power plant and all the equipment. If the price of Bitcoin falls below a certain level, I start losing money. This is fine for a while. I can hedge it with futures contracts, or I can operate at a loss for a few months if I think the price will go higher again later. But if this goes on long enough, miners start turning off their rigs. Maybe I sell my energy to the grid instead of mining crypto. Only the most efficient miners can keep going when BTC falls, and that forms a natural price floor at their lowest possible operating costs. When all the weakest miners have capitulated, and the strongest can mine at near break-even costs, the Bitcoin price finds a bottom and stabilizes. Because of the halving, that break-even cost shifts higher every 4 years. The halving cuts the daily supply in half, which means miner revenue gets cut in half. The break-even price floor has to move higher. One study found that Bitcoin's historical price action was 81% accurate with the marginal costs of mining production. Or you can use the 200-day moving average. I'm not a trader, but it's hard to argue with this. BTC has never dropped below the 200-day moving average, which is currently sitting around $7,000. You can think of this as another floor for the Bitcoin price. However you value it, Bitcoin is still the best performing asset of the last decade, and even a small allocation to BTC has the potential to produce massive overall returns. Great for large investors, life-changing for younger investors. I think it's fair to say we've established Bitcoin as a strong investment asset. But how do we get from here to global reserve currency? To figure that out, we need to go back into the history of money. This is going to get deep. But what we'll discover is that Bitcoin isn't just digital money. It's the best form of money ever created. And its place as the global reserve currency is almost inevitable. Chapter 9. If ramen is money, so is Bitcoin. Gustavo Goose Alvarez was serving a 6-year prison sentence when a riot broke out in his cell block. He was trapped. Gang members were breaking down the door, and these guys were fired up. Goose knew that racial tensions and gang affiliations were supercharged in prison. He was scared. He and his cellmates made makeshift weapons from anything they could and tied towels around their neck to protect from knives. When the door finally broke, the bloodthirsty inmates rushed in. This was it for Goose. He said a few prayers and braced for a massacre. Suddenly, out of nowhere, two guys came to their rescue. After a long talk back and forth, they somehow convinced the inmates to calm down. How did they do it? The answer was money. Well, prison money. They slipped the attackers a packet of ramen. A few hours later, Goose was cooking noodles for the gang members as if nothing had ever happened. Jail economies have always run on their own currency, usually cigarettes. But since 2004, when tobacco was banned from federal prisons, the currency of choice became instant ramen packets, referred to in prison as soups. You can tell how good a man's doing, financially, by how many soups he's got in his locker. 20 soups? Oh, that guy's doing good. Prison is like the streets. You use currency for everything. In here, it's soups. Inmate. Ramen has become the major currency in US federal prisons. It's used to buy candy, clothing, cosmetics, and other food items. Inmates use ramen to pay for services like laundry or bunk cleaning, even security from other inmates. They play poker using ramen packets as chips. If you're locked up, ramen is more valuable than the dollar. I've seen fights over ramen. People get killed over soup, Alvarez said. An entire financial system has sprung up around instant noodles. In some prisons, inmates build up large ramen reserves and lend them out to their prisoners. They even have a credit rating system. If you regularly pay back your soups, you can borrow more. And then, of course, there are ramen debt collectors. Back when cigarettes were the major prison currency, inmates would pay the guards in cigarettes for special benefits. The cigarettes were a form of tax paid to the higher powers. Even if prisoners hate instant noodles or cigarettes, they stockpile as much as they can, so they can trade them later on. A form of prison saving and investing. The soups can even go up in value. Alvarez explains, I remember in 92, you could get them for 20 cents a ramen. In 2013, the last time I was in prison, they were equivalent to $1 a ramen, sometimes two. In some prisons, two soups can buy a $10 sweater, showing the power of appreciation. Goods and services are also denominated in food packets. You want your bunk cleaned? That'll be two soups. You want protection for a week? Five soups. Ask any economist. This system satisfies all the main functions of money. One, it's a store of value. Inmates stockpile soups to build wealth. Two, it's a medium of exchange. Prisoners exchange the soups and use them as payment. Three, it's a unit of account. Goods and services are denominated in soups. Anything can be money. The reason I'm telling you about ramen is because it proves one big thing. Anything can be money. Money does not have to be issued or controlled by a government. Money is anything that other people or other groups decide is valuable and are willing to exchange. Throughout history, money is simply something you owe to someone else. As Jacob Goldstein put it, the true story of a made-up thing. The founding father of economics, Adam Smith, said, "All money is a matter of belief. If we all agree that something has value, it can become money. So if ramen can be money, then so can anything. So can Bitcoin." This is the mental leap we need to make as we get deeper in this book. The cash in your bank account today is not the only option. If we agree that anything can be money, the next logical question is, what makes good money? Let's go back to noodles again. Ramen actually has all the qualities of a good money. One, it's durable. Instant noodles don't perish. Two, it comes in a standard unit. Three, it's fungible. Each packet of ramen is identical and therefore equally valuable as another. Four, it's light and portable. Five, it's non-forgeable. You can't recreate a packet of ramen. Six, it's desirable. It has intrinsic value. Inmates want to eat it because the main prison food sucks. Prison ramen has another good quality, one that modern government monies have abandoned. Scarcity. Ramen is valued in prison because it's relatively hard to get your hands on. And here's where it gets interesting. If you eat one of your ramen packets, the total supply of ramen in the prison goes down. In economic terms, ramen is a deflationary monetary system. You eat one, that makes them even more scarce, and therefore more valuable. It's like Bitcoin. If someone loses a Bitcoin, it's gone forever. One of the 21 million is basically burned, making all the others more valuable. I actually think prison ramen is better money than the dollar. I know that sounds crazy, but when you look back through history, it makes sense. The next few sections get pretty deep down the rabbit hole of money. But there's one thing I want you to think about as we go through. For most of history, good money has been like prison ramen and Bitcoin, scarce. Our current dollar system has abandoned scarcity in favor of money printing. And every time something like it was tried through history, it failed, really badly. We'll discover that Bitcoin is actually just a return to good, hard, scarce money. Bitcoin isn't the crazy experiment here. The dollar is. Chapter 10. Ancient money printer go brrr. There's a temple in Indonesia where long-tailed macaque monkeys accumulate human trinkets like sunglasses, cameras, hats and wallets. And they only give them back or exchange them for food. For most tourists, it's a funny story to tell, but this is the most primitive form of money, barter. The monkeys are bartering with us. This is the origin of money, according to most economists. Even as cavemen, we had an innate desire to collect and hoard things, especially rare items like flint, animal teeth, skins. They were passed down through generations and exchanged in rituals. We made necklaces and pendants and gave them value. This is one of the things that separated us from primitive versions of man, and it's how all good money begins, collecting something valuable. Within tribes, the economy mostly ran on gift-giving and favours. I owe you some fish for the bread that you made last week. But what happens if you want to trade with another tribe? That's how barter developed. We would exchange flint or skins with another tribe for something else of value, maybe fruit, grains, or cattle. This was the earliest system of trade, and it triggered the start of the human race as we know it. For the first time, humans could co-cooperate outside their family group. Slowly, tribes began to anticipate what other tribes might want in the future, just like the macaque monkeys in Indonesia, so they would accumulate items they think others will want. Communities near the sea would accumulate fish reserves to barter with inland tribes who wanted the fish. Some anthropologists say this was probably more of a credit system, especially among friendly tribes. In Mesopotamia, they created an early credit system with clay coins. A ball of clay with five circles on it meant I owe you five sheep. This is game theory. We collect things we think will be valuable to others in the future. By the way, this is why so many people are accumulating Bitcoin now. We hoard it now, anticipating that it will be worth more to others in the future as a form of trade. By accumulating early, you give yourself an edge in the future. Collecting and storing value is the starting point of all good money through history. The problem with barter comes when one group doesn't want what the other is offering. You can't trade with the fishing community if you decide you don't want fish anymore. And you can't trade with your enemies either. You can't trust them to give them the fish or honor an IOU. Now we need a currency, something that both groups agree is valuable. The earliest form of currency was pretty similar to prison ramen. It was barley. Like ramen, barley has the properties of good money. Durable, light, uniform, fungible, desirable, and relatively scarce. As more people agreed that barley was good money, trade exploded. Think about it. You can now trade with anyone, even your enemies, so long as they believe that barley has value. Just like Goose Alvarez could make temporary peace with his prison enemies using ramen, early tribes could even trade with rival groups. The only problem with grain money is that it's difficult to transport in large quantities. You can't drag huge barrels of barley to the market every time you want to buy something. So it was eventually replaced by portable coins. Chinese communities were the first to create a coin in 770 BC. And each coin was backed by a real-life scarce object, a tool or a weapon. About 100 years later, a region of Turkey began minting coins from gold, a naturally scarce metal. They even had different values. coins were stamped with lions, snakes, and owls to denominate different amounts. In both cases, trade exploded in these regions. This happened a lot throughout history. When a new form of simple currency is adopted by a large group, it triggers insane growth and development in those regions. That region in Turkey briefly became one of the richest empires in the world. Since then, gold, silver, and other precious metals have always been considered good money and formed the basis of most currencies, in some form, up until 1971. Like ramen and barley, gold has all the practical features of good money, but most importantly, it's incredibly scarce. Gold is one of the rarest assets on Earth, and it's difficult to get out of the ground. It requires work. As we know, humans gravitate towards scarce items, which is what made gold the basis of money for centuries. Ancient money printer go brrr. Around 1500 years later, roughly 800 AD, everything changed. The Chinese Tang Dynasty invented the first ever paper money. Fed up of dragging large chunks of metal across the empire, the government issued flying cash, a paper note that could be redeemed for gold in China's capital. Shopkeepers named it flying cash because it kept blowing away in the wind. Again, trade exploded across the empire. No one actually bothered to swap their flying cash for the gold reserves. Everyone accepted the paper as a form of currency. Each note also came with a warning. Those who are counterfeiting will be decapitated. They weren't joking. One guy was sentenced to death for printing thousands of fake bills. This also became the first real government money. All other forms of currency were banned. For the first time, a government forced its citizens to use the same money, instead of letting the free market decide what to use. At this point in history, Confucian scholars made the most accurate prediction of all time. They rebelled against this government paper money and warned that it would lead to governments printing and weakening their own currency. They argued that money should be left in the hands of the private market, which would make sure it stayed competitive and held value. They basically predicted the future. Still, at this point, at least you could go to the capital and swap your notes for an equal amount in gold or silver reserves. Every note was backed by the same amount of real metal. This went on for almost 400 years, until the incoming Qin dynasty got greedy. They stopped backing the paper currency with gold and silver reserves. They just printed more out of thin air. Ancient money printer go brrr. The Confucian scholars were right. For the first time in history, hyperinflation happened. As the supply of paper notes soared, their value decreased. Prices rose dramatically, and there was an explosion in credit and borrowing. The following Yan dynasty did the same thing. In a period of 50 years, the currency depreciated by almost 100%. Just put that in perspective. Centuries of trade were destroyed in 50 years because of money printing. By 1455, merchants refused to accept the paper money because it was effectively worthless. The Yan dynasty realized their mistake, and paper money was eliminated. China went back to a silver economy until the 20th century. This is the first time the world learned the difference between hard money and soft money. Hard money, like gold, which is scarce and difficult to obtain, holds its value much better than soft money. Soft money, like paper, which is artificially created and unbacked by hard assets, is abundant. And so, it inevitably loses its value over time. It's hard to overstate this. Scarcity matters when it comes to value in money. Without scarcity, money becomes worthless over time. And that's why Bitcoin is the best money ever created. It's the first truly finite asset on the planet.